We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order, and we are going to depart slightly from our agenda because we don't know where Representative Doubt is. He was waylaid somewhere on his way down here. We're going to start off with House File 343, Representative Atkins. And we are going to start the hearings, even though we are not official yet. We're one or two members away from a quorum, but we will proceed with testimony and start the agenda. Representative Atkins, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 343 to the consent calendar.
Representative Atkins, whenever you're ready.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to have House File 343 heard. This would be, as I understand it, model legislation, first of its kind in the country to deal with an issue that is big, growing, and just getting worse. Internet, the idea of internet scams and the sort of things that would be impacted by this bill are ones that we oftentimes kind of make fun of. It's you get the email that says you won the sweepstakes or your uncle died. Just send him your Social Security number and your bank account number, and we a lot of folks unfortunately make fun of those sorts of scams. They are far more sophisticated than what people give them credit for, and they build up long-term relationships with people over time, and eventually take great advantage sometimes of our most vulnerable folks, but also of some very highly educated, thoughtful people that just get lured in by these very sophisticated, and now not only are they growing, but they've grown in their sophistication, and that they, as I understand it, are being perpetrated by organized crime because they've proven to be so profitable. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think it's much more valuable that you hear from people that are on the front lines. There's Mr. Arlt, who I'd invite to join me from the Department of Public Safety, who can walk you through what the scope of this issue is. And then some people who've been personally impacted by it. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Arlt.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And Mr. Arlt, please proceed when you're ready. Identify yourself for the tape and then please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Arlt. I'm the Interim Director for the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. On behalf of the Department of Public Safety, and in particular the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The scam or fraud types of financial crimes appear to be growing at an epidemic rate. There's one reason why, and that's because they work. We deal specifically with the lottery sweepstakes and prize giveaway type of scams where the intended victims receive a phone call, they receive an email, or they receive a regular mail solicitation notifying them that they've won a lottery, a sweepstakes, or prize giveaway, and all they need to do to claim their prize is to end up sending money. Now, I've been with the state of Minnesota in this division for 20 years. I've been in law enforcement for 33. And as we were going along here in the Alcohol and Gambling Divorce Enforcement Division, we ended up starting to see a rapid rise in complaints from Minnesota citizens, typically the elderly, of being victims of lottery sweepstakes and prize giveaway type of scams. We ended up deciding to end up doing a study, and during that study and talking with law enforcement that was already dealing with this type of crime, we found out that less than 5% of the victims will report the crime to any law enforcement agency. Half of those victims will end up lying about actually sending money because of embarrassment. And probably less than 1% of the criminal activity information would actually get to the international law enforcement agency that could end up dealing with the crime. Now, these type of scams have historically been considered difficult crimes for law enforcement to investigate. In fact, the National Attorney General's, along with our agency and other agencies, basically were just telling people, don't send any money. You know, just don't fall victim to it. But there are reasons why law enforcement has had difficulty in dealing with these types of crimes. The first of all is the crook was never in our jurisdiction. Most of the crimes that we deal with in law enforcement, the crook is there when they perpetrate the crime. There's a lack of financial resources to send investigators to different countries. Also, law enforcement, to be honest, has not necessarily shared information very well on the information that we did receive. Lastly, our companies in the United States do business in a manner that make this crime very difficult for the victim to figure out they are being victimized and for law enforcement to investigate the crimes. First of all, with money transfer companies, local law enforcement has to deal with the inability for victims to report where their money actually went to. You can be sending money from Hastings to Red Wing, and can be picked up anywhere in the United States. And if you're the one that's sending the money, you're never notified your money got picked up somewhere different than where you were sending it to. That makes it awful hard for victims to know where their money went. The money goes out on what's called a will call basis, which means that they basically the crooks can pick it up wherever they want to. There's also a code, typically, that can be put on the form that the crooks know about and end up telling the victims about, where you can put in there my favorite color and the answer being yellow. And if the crook will know that and they know the money transfer number by getting it from the victim, they can pick up that money transfer not only anywhere within the country where it's being sent, they can pick it up anonymously and never have to show any sort form of identification. These types of things make it very tough for law enforcement to know where even to start following up. There's been another problem in dealing as far as with money transfer companies, and this was exposed by the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission conducted a study of money transfers being conducted by MoneyGram between the United States and Canada. What the Federal Trade Commission report showed was that 79.8% of the monies being transferred during that time period was being sent between the United States and Canada was being sent due to fraud. Less than 10% of their authorized agent locations were actually involved in the fraudulent transactions, so it made it a very narrow scope of authorized agent locations that could have been dealt with. The Federal Trade Commission report also said that the MoneyGram had fired and disciplined employees that wanted to implement the company's anti-fraud measures. There was also law enforcement reports indicating telephone boiler rooms operating right inside of MoneyGram locations in Canada. The Federal Trade Commission, which is made up of attorneys and are not nearly as flippant as I am as an old cop, ended up basically laying out a charge that MoneyGram was intentionally facilitating fraud. There was an announcement in October 2009 of a settlement payment of $18 million. It should be noted that this study of MoneyGram's business practices was directly after review of their business practices by the attorney generals in various states, where they reached an agreement with MoneyGram, where MoneyGram funded $1.1 million for a national consumer awareness campaign. Also, there's telephone companies, and one of the things that senior citizens rely on is caller ID. And caller ID or identification spoofing is very common. The crooks very easily know about that. I know about it. And it's very simple to end up making people's caller identification end up showing whatever the person wants it to. So I can make it end up showing up as your local police department, your local medical clinic, your local biggest bank in your area, and think about the questions I can end up asking at that point in time. There's also the ability to purchase our telephone numbers anywhere in the world by the crooks. And they intentionally use 202 area codes when they try and lay it out that they're with the Federal Trade Commission or the IRS, and they use 702 area codes, which is Las Vegas, when they want to make it look like they're either with a gambling commission or with some other type of gambling entity. Now, our program started in September of 2007. We have received over 90,000 complaints since our program started. Last year, we had reported losses of over $4.1 million. We have had over $2 million in reported losses so far in the first 2 months of this year. We have two special agents and administrative assistant assigned to our efforts. We have assisted in developing cases that have been and are being prosecuted in the United States, Jamaica, Canada, and we've assisted citizens of Minnesota in getting some or all their money back. Now, we share information that we receive from local law enforcement, banks, and other entities, AARP and others that we've partnered with. And besides receiving that information, we share it with the international law enforcement agency that can do something about this crime. Our agency estimates that Minnesota citizens, and typically they're the elderly, lose approximately $30 million every year. This is money they're not going to make back. The suspects, we're advised by international law enforcement agencies that the suspects can be and are members of traditional organized crime, Eastern European organized crime, West African organized crime, at least one of our more notorious outlaw motorcycle groups, and in possibly at least one or more terrorist groups. We have had cases where between where the calls would originate from and where the monies are being wired to, it would give indication that we have suspects in multiple countries. And just following up on one telephone number, looking at the activity from that one telephone number, indicated the potential of over 6,000 victims. So on the one hand, we have the Minnesota senior citizen as the intended victim, and on the other hand, we have these groups. It doesn't sound very fair. Now, they target the senior citizens because their memory becomes more unreliable over the years. They can postpone as far as prosecution, for it can take up to 7 years to get extradited out of Canada. And during that time period, the memory of senior citizens becomes a little bit more vulnerable, and possibly some of them pass away. Again, this is a very lucrative crime. It's just one of the many scams that are out there. The same groups are doing all of the scams. And there's really no reason why they wouldn't. There is way too much money to be made. Thank you very much. I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Any questions from members? Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me do the test first. Have other states enacted legislation like this, and what have been the results? Does this seem to work?
Mr. Arnold.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, other states have not enacted legislation like this. There is questions about getting this type of thing when we end up meeting for our fraud conferences, which is international law enforcement agencies meeting together, and there's questions made of the money transmittal companies where they basically say it's our business practice and we're not going to change it unless we actually have to.
Representative Stensrud, does that answer your question? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stensrud asked my question. Thank you.
See no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
Okay. Can I make one more point, sir?
Sure.
Okay. The point that I would like to end up making is that with this provision that is still part of this bill, is it allows for when we're working with victims that have now maybe realized that they are victims and they continue to get contacted by the crooks, if the money would have to go to a specific location with our international law enforcement partners, we can work with them on sending money, and when that money is picked up, the international law enforcement agency then can assist, that can assist them in investigating and figuring out where these crimes are coming from.
Thank you, sir. Representative Atkins, do you have others that want to come down? And
I do, Mr. Chairman, and I don't necessarily know what order they're coming down. I just invite them to come on down and join us.
And as maybe, you know, we love surprises.
Well, you know, I think it's all supportive. But I did want to, Mr. Chair, I wasn't sure at the outset if we had a quorum or not, but I did want to move. There's a DE1 amendment that'll put it in the shape.
We do have a quorum. We were just wondering if you wanted to do that now. We can, if you want to go ahead and offer the amendment, we can.
Why don't we do that, Mr. Chairman, as the testifiers are coming down? I'll move the DE1 amendment, which would put it in the shape that the author desires to move it forward.
Okay. Members, any questions to the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And while we're adopting things, does anybody want to move the minutes from our last meeting since we are official now? I will move the minutes from the last meeting. Thank you, members, for your cooperation. Any questions about those minutes from the last meeting? Seeing none, those in favor of adopting the minutes from the last meeting, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members, for your cooperation. The minutes are adopted. We are official. We have the amendment before it. The bill is now in the shape the author would like. Welcome to our committee. We're glad it was you. Please identify yourself with the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, if I can mention one other thing, and that is I normally try to meet with my witnesses before I present a bill. I apologize to the folks coming here to testify. We were on the floor until just a few minutes before we came over to committee. But there are also, I believe in your packets, there's a long list of supporters for this bill. Mm-hmm. the Anti-Fraud Partnership and all the members of that organization, bankers and credit unions and so forth, but also the folks from AARP. I didn't want to give short shrift to those folks. I meant to mention them at the outset. With that, I will turn it over to the chief.
Thank you. And Representative Atkins, we do have, I think, two letters from AARP, and we have two other people after the chief that have identified wanting to come down and speak. So with that, chief, identify yourself for the tape, and please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chief Eastman, and I work at Bayport Police Department. I've been there for 7 years. I have four full-time staff, licensed officers, and four part-time officers, so we're real small. Our population is approximately 34,000, and having said that, we have been affected by this crime as well. In April of last year, I received a call from Social Services that he was concerned about an elderly gentleman who was giving a lot of finances to this scam. It was a publishing clearinghouse scam. I spent 6 months and 20 pages of dictation trying to recover some of this funds, do administrative subpoenas. I got a hold of the anti-fraud unit. Actually, James got a hold of me, and he said, we're here to assist, and thank goodness he was. We just don't have the resources. Ultimately, the senior lost $40,000. He was about to be evicted from his home, and we're just asking that you consider that this is a vessel. The money wiring is a vessel for criminal activity. We're hoping that if you ask that a specific person picks the funds up and the specific location, then that will also assist us to eliminate that. In the conversation of the investigation, at one point when I was in the home of this elderly man, I was on the phone pretending to be the wife of, with a permission from our victims. And one of the scam artists told me when he realized that I was the chief that in his country they kill law enforcement officers when they interfere with the scam. So he wasn't intimidated by me at all. And these poor people almost got evicted and lost $40,000. So that's why I'm here today, and I appreciate your time. If you have any questions.
I hope that country wasn't Canada.
No, sir.
I was assuming it was not. Thank you, Chief.
We believe it was Jamaica.
Thank you, Chief. Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Welcome, ma'am. If you could identify yourself for the record, please proceed whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you to Mr. Chair. My name is Kim Holbrook, and I'm a volunteer with AARP and a member of AARP's Fraud Fighters team. On behalf of AARP, we want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for this hearing on House File 343 today. AARP has been helping seniors across Minnesota learn about how to avoid frauds and scams. We've had several forums to educate consumers about avoiding these crimes, and in the process, we've heard stories from all corners of the state about the crimes and how they steal money from seniors and take away their financial security.
Ma'am, Ms. Holbrook?
Yes?
Is this the letter, the one we have?
I assume so.
Oh, okay. If you want to just hit some of the highlights,
sure.
Members can read that, and while they're sitting quietly paying attention, they read things that we have in our packet. So if there's anything specific from here or anything else you want us to know, let us know, and we will keep this and read this, or members will read it as we're going through here.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
I think the main thing I wanted to say was that in the case, the granny scam is what we have heard most about the state, and that's basically where senior citizens are being scammed by people who are calling in, befriending them, forming a relationship with them. These scammers are really, really good, and they believe that the people calling to be their grandson or granddaughter and in dire need. So there's an urgency that they put on there, and that is really what is causing so many heartaches among our seniors. I also am a victim of internet fraud, which is not exactly specific to this, but I've been a victim of that through my small business. I've lost hundreds of dollars, and I consider myself a well-educated and a smart woman. And unfortunately, I was new to what I was trying to do, but the impact on Minnesotans continues to grow. we are losing, as you said, $30 million a year approximately. And it really, this stopping the wire transfers and having more identification for people who receive the money is the main thing that we're asking for today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, questions? Thank you. Is Mr. Paul Bowmaster here? Welcome, Mr. Bowmaster. If you could identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Paul Bowmaster, I'm the Race County Attorney. I wasn't prepared that this was going to be on the amendment, but the amendment is a great start. I do think here in Minnesota we have been very good about being on the cutting edge of internet crimes. I know in my community I started a program for education, and it's Citizens Against Exploitation of Seniors. And part of that program is making us a hard target and making it so criminals don't want to do criminal activity in the state of Minnesota. We send out warnings on a monthly basis about different crimes that are occurring. We receive those from the Commerce Department oftentimes, from the state when we get alerts. At this point, one of the things that the amendment will be addressing is at least knowing who to prosecute, making sure that they have to identify themselves if they're taking those funds. I think that's a good start. Some of the other things that I think this committee might want to look at in the future will be, how do we centralize investigation? How do we establish clear jurisdictional boundaries as to who's responsible? We have communities where citizens get emails that may seem silly, and who would ever respond to them? But they don't know where to go to. They'll go to their local law enforcement, who oftentimes has no idea what to do with somebody in Nigeria who's sending a scam email to them. Fortunately, we do have the Minnesota Internet Crimes Task Force that we do receive support in our smaller communities, such as mine in Rice County, that they do help us try to track down the perpetrators and that are sending out these scams. It is a growing area of crime, and it's one where I think most states aren't sure how to address it. It's not happening in our neighborhoods. It's happening outside of what is traditionally our jurisdiction. And how do we establish a law enforcement regimen that will allow for quick investigation and an even faster response in shutting down those scam sites? They are using our infrastructure, our internet structure, to commit these crimes. I think we owe it to our citizens to make sure that that is not allowed, and that when it is found out to be a scam, that we are shutting it down. It will, I think, make the internet a safer place to do business and make people more eager to do business on the internet. I do hope that you will give this bill, as amended, your support. I think it is a good start, and it's important that at least we know who is taking the money at the end of the other line, wherever that may be. Thank you. I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bowmaster. Any questions, members? I think you wowed them, and they don't have any questions. We also had Julie Reamer on the list. If you want to come on down and identify yourself with the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Julie Reamer.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm here because my dad is a victim. Jim said, do you need a tissue? I said, no, I got this. Anyway, my dad essentially was highly respected in the medical community. He managed multi-million-dollar hospital constructions, and he was a smart guy. About a year ago, he started receiving phone calls from people, and he was targeted to give over money. In exchange for that, he would receive a sum of money in return. And we thought, well, he had to do this one time, so after the first transaction, he would come to his senses. But we were wrong, and he became more and more entrenched with this fellow. And essentially since, in about a year, year and a half, he's lost over 100. $140,000. He's lost his entire retirement, all of his savings. He's tapped about $40,000 in credit card cash advances. He's cashed out his life insurance, which my mom is supposed to live on after he passes. He has tried to collateralize his assets to borrow money, and he's tried to borrow money from my sister, whose husband is home with leukemia. Anyway, it's bad. He can't break free of the hold that this guy has on him, and it will carry him to his grave. I see this in my business as a financial advisor, and I have many seniors who are also targeted, and it's exploding. And they come to me and they say, "Is this real? And should I do this?" So I feel a little bit like an expert in understanding where they're coming from, but I can't understand how much of a hold these people have on these senior citizens. And as you know, the demographics are just going to grow. So much money is going to leave the country. I managed to intercede with my dad and obtain conservatorship after such a long time. But if I hadn't, he would be homeless. He would not have any medical insurance. We not have any long-term care insurance. Right now he lives on his fixed income, and I pay their bills for them. And so we're blessed in that regard, but it could have been different for them. And it's ruined, basically, our relationship. He sneaks around, and he borrows money from some of his friends and some of his neighbors, and he tries to do things that are not my dad. So I encourage you to consider this bill. For not only my dad, for all the other people that follow behind him. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Reamer. Members, any questions?
Sure.
No questions. Representative Atkins, is there anyone else that you wanted to have come and speak in this?
No, Mr. Chairman. We could have had lots and lots of people come and join us.
I know. I've seen the emails.
But they're actually coming to the question about has this happened elsewhere? This law is, those emails are coming in from across the country. There's a bunch of Minnesotans among that group as well. But the word has spread that somebody's finally trying to do something, and it's practical. Under the Delete All Amendment, all we do is just ask that people show up with an ID. And that if it's the money's trying to be picked up someplace other than where it was sent, that the sender gets notice of that. And from Mr. Alton, Mr. County Attorney Bowmaster, the police chief, I think we'll all tell you that if we just simply do that, that will stem a great deal of this tide of money flowing out of Minnesota. Primarily from senior citizens and the most vulnerable people among us. Many of them are really smart folks, but they're just absolutely taken advantage of. They're befriended over months and months and months, and they're just taken advantage of over and over and over again. And Mr. Chairman, I think there's folks here from MoneyGram for sure. I don't know about Western Union. I have had a chance to visit with them, and they've indicated to me they're welcome to come and say this as well, but that they're looking forward to working with us on trying to figure out how this bill can move forward. I would ask, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the informational hearing, if there's still an opportunity to possibly pass the bill yet this session, even in 12 days, now that it's in the stripped-down, focused version, that you give some consideration to that.
We will, Representative Atkins, thank you, and we will give that consideration and think about it. It is, I'm a co-author on it. I do like it better in the stripped-down version. Members, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this? With that, thank you, Representative Atkins. We'll
okay.
Ma'am, if you're going to speak, could you come down so we can...
Thank you.
And if you could identify yourself for
the
record. And
I got excited because this is something I'm passionate about. My name is Sean Mosh, and I am the co-founder of Scam Victims United. And my husband and I started this group in 2002 after we became victims of a counterfeit cashier's check scam. This is not just happening to the elderly. Happened to me, happened to my husband. We were selling a car online, lost over $7,000. I can tell you that if the items in this bill were law in 2002, I would not be sitting here speaking to you as a scam victim. That's how well this would help to stop scams. A lot of those emails that you've been talking about coming across the country, I put the word out to my fellow scam victims through our website and some of the people that I've worked with that operate other scam fighting websites. I said, yes, I know this is Minnesota and it's not the state you live in, but let's pass this in Minnesota and let's be the groundbreaking state in Minnesota, and then we'll come and do it in your state. And they said, just tell me where to send that email. And they were all on board.
Well, they certainly found us.
Well, I made sure of that. I feel so strongly that this is something that needs to happen. I've been asking and begging for many of these things since 2002 when I started speaking to anybody who would listen to me. And I'm honored to be here speaking in front of you to once again say, please make this law and let's make a difference.
Thank you, Ms. Mosh. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This could be for Representative Atkins or the testifier, whoever chooses to answer. I'm just a little baffled as to who would be against this. Who would be against it?
There's some folks in Jamaica and Nigeria and elsewhere that, and probably here in the country that, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, that would certainly oppose this. And the money transmitters, to the extent that it makes it a little bit more complicated for them to do business. I know that they've outright said they do not oppose the bill, but they want to make sure that it is workable in context of their business. So we've started that discussion about how can we still make it workable. But the point of, you know, and Mr. Arlt pointed out, Mr. Bowmaster did, is that if we know where they are receiving the funds, then we can bust them. So that's why the location is important. And if we know this is all that's left of the bill, but it's, in my perception, two of the very most important pieces. And the second one is if they have to show who they are. Because right now, as the testifier, Ms. Mosh, and others will tell you, they misrepresent who they are. They pretend to be your grandchild, or they pretend to be in a relationship with you, or they're a business person who's based abroad. They don't have to show up with any form of identification at all. They can just go, as long as they've got the confirmation number or the code words or whatever it happens to be, they can collect that money.
The money we wired was sent to Philadelphia on the form we sent filled out, but because they knew the transfer number and the secret code word, they picked it up in Nigeria.
Representative Dietrich, does that answer your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, yes. But I just have one follow-up comment. Is that I see that, you know, you need to have a government-issued photo ID. Well, I think we're on the way to getting that with our voter identification bill that we just passed. So I'm wondering what the obstacles are now.
And Representative Stensrud, did you have a question, or is this something you could ask offline? We do need to move on to our other bills on the agenda. And folks, I would caution everybody in the audience, we're not going to have any more comments from the audience. If you come up, if you need to make a comment, you can come up and testify. There will not be any more audience comments on this bill or any other bill. Thank you. Representative Atkins, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the hearing, and I should, for the record, I moved it to the consent calendar. I will withdraw the motion to the consent calendar, but would appreciate it if you give some thought to moving it to the general register.
We will give that some thought. Thank you, and members will lay this bill over for right now and move on to Representative Dowd. Representative Dowd moves House File 1637. Representative Dowd, whenever you're ready.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like to move DE1 amendment.
Okay.
To get, and that's to the, get the bill in the shape.
Okay. Representative Dowd moves the DE1 amendment. Members, any questions on this amendment? Seeing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape that the author would like it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Basically, the bill gives a homeowner the right to, upon written request, be given the information on who holds the loan that's secured by their mortgage. It requires the mortgage servicers and transaction agents to provide that information to the borrower. So it's pretty simple language. I'm going to appreciate your support.
Okay. And ma'am, if you want to identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. The original language for this bill was brought to us by the Senate author, and we worked with her to come up with language that we were comfortable with. We hope it'll help some homeowners. We'd like to thank Representative Dowd for carrying this bill. And I can answer any questions about the bill that you may have.
Okay. And members, it is our intention, and Representative Mallory, I'll get to you in just a second. It is the intention to lay this bill over, and we're hearing it for informational purposes. I'm not sure where it is in the Senate or where we're going with it down the road, but we did want to have it talked about, so we at least had a committee hearing on it this year. Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forget your name from the bankers, but first of all, thanks for now giving in, and we tried to put this in the bills back in previous years, in the 2008 bill, but the lenders objected. But I do have a question on what number one, two questions. I'm worried about the actual knowledge that's in there now, and second of all, what is the Dodd-Frank, how do you comply with Dodd-Frank that's different from this?
Ms. Rice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, on the Dodd-Frank question, it is almost identical. This bill brings in transaction agents, meaning MERS, but the language is almost identical. Any homeowner can get, they have to make a written request under Dodd-Frank, and they'll get the name of the owner of their mortgage.
I see.
But Representative Mullery.
But they, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but if they choose to do the Dodd-Frank, then they can't get the MERS information? Is that what you're saying, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery. No, Dodd-Frank isn't effective yet. It won't be effective for at least 18 months. And so the author was hoping to start this sooner. So all lenders would need to comply with this as of August 1st if it were enacted, and then also MERS as well. So MERS would have to take requests and.
They would?
Yes, okay. And servicers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And Representative O'Driscoll or Stensrud, did somebody have a question over here? Sorry, I thought I saw. Any other questions, members? Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against this? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Rice, and thank you, Representative Dowd. With that, we will lay 1637. We will lay it over. We are waiting for Representative Westrom to arrive. Members, while we're waiting for Representative Westrom to come down, we're finding out just now that we have a potential amendment from, I believe, from the author for this bill that we're going to have copied and distributed. I apologize for this not being in the members' packets on and available for the public. I didn't know that this was going to be amended until about 15 seconds ago. Members, we can't get Representative Westrom down here on this, and we have an amendment that we didn't know about, so we're going to try to get him out of Ways and Means and try to get him down here, but in the meantime, we're not going to sit and waste everybody's time, so we'll move on with the agenda. We'll move on to House File 610, and we'll try to fit Representative Westrom in later if there's time at the end of the hearing. So with that, if Representative Hilty's here and wants to come on down, and we'll get started. I will go ahead and move House File 610. Representative Hilty and Mr. Dale, welcome to the committee. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to present this bill today. It is only an informational hearing. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am under no illusion that this bill has the prospect of being passed by this legislature or any other in the immediate future. I did agree to sponsor Mr. Dale's bill because I thought that it was a subject that really needed to be considered. Mr. Chair, if you indulge me for just a moment to build a base, I'd like to give a little background on this. Mr. Chair, I know that
certainly
you and a number of other members of the committee are familiar with a video, which is now also a book called The Crash Course, which a couple of years ago in the Energy Committee, which I chaired at the time, and Mr. Chair, which you and I believe Representative Atkins, Johnson, and Representative Slocum were all members of that committee at the time. We spent a couple sessions of the committee viewing that video, which I thought was extremely important, and I still do. What I found important about it was that it kind of provided an answer to the question that I had had for some time. It occurred to me quite some time ago now that in most circumstances, it's really a good idea to try to understand what the unquestioned assumptions are and question them. I've tried to make that a practice in as many situations as I could. And one of the major unquestioned assumptions with respect to the economy is simply that growth is necessary and good. Mr. Chair, I felt that the crash course that I devoted that time to in committee a couple years ago provided something of an answer
to that question, and it's a negative answer. What that video points out and what I've come to understand is that we have an economy that is predicated, is absolutely requires exponential growth. Every aspect of the economy is predicated upon exponential growth, and it's a very difficult concept for many people to understand. Dr. Albert Bartlett is a distinguished mathematician, I believe, from retired now from the University of Colorado or Colorado State, pointed out and is quoted by any number of people in various circumstances that one of the great failings of the human intellect is its inability to understand the exponential function. Basically, what occurs with compound interest. Members, what we have not only in this country currently, but pretty much globally, is a monetary system that is premised on exponential growth. Because the only way that money is created in this economy is through the issuance of debt. That's very clear. It's indisputable. You can check the website of any of the Federal Reserve branches across the country, and what you will learn is that money is created basically out of thin air. When the Federal Reserve writes a check, there's nothing to back it up. And the only way money is created, with the exception of minting of coins or, well, it's only with the exception of hard currency, and even that is not distributed into circulation. It's loaned into circulation. But all money is created as debt. And the problem that we have with that system is that if the amount of money in circulation is equivalent to the amount of debt that exists, there isn't any provision for paying the interest on that money, on those loans. So we're committed to a process whereby the only way you can create money to account for the interest on the debt that exists is to create more debt, because that's the only way you can create more money. This is, I think simple logic can tell us, at some point unsustainable. We have seen in the last decade the exponential growth of debt in this economy from roughly $28 trillion in the year 2000 to, I think, the current figure is $57 trillion. And we're on a course for that to be increasing exponentially. And I would remind members that there is a simple way of calculating exponential growth, which is called the rule of 70. If you want to know over what time period something that's growing at a given rate will double, you simply divide whatever rate it's growing by into 70. If something's growing by 2% per year, for instance, in 35 years it will have doubled. If it's growing at 5% per year, in 14 years it will have doubled. And what that doubling means is that we're doubling all of the resources in the economy, if we're talking about the economy growing at that rate, and we're talking about the doubling of the money supply as well. So, kind of leads to the question, once you understand that that's the path that we're on, is, are there really any alternatives? Mr. Dale, who is the author of this proposal that's before us in House File 610, has studied the situation for a long time, and I think has come up with an interesting proposal. And as I said, I am under no illusion that this has any prospect of becoming law in this state or in any other for the present time. But I think that what he has to say about how this can work is something that's really worth thinking about. Mr. Chair, I hope that we can have a relatively casual conversation about this. I would certainly encourage members to listen to what Mr. Dale has to say and pose questions. It's a very difficult concept to get one's head around, but I think it's something that we really need to be thinking about. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask Mr. Dale to describe what is proposed in the bill and the reasoning that is behind it.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Mr. Dale, if you could identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Chairman Hoppe and members of the Commerce Committee, my name is Byron Dale. As he's correct, I have studied this for many years. I've authored 4 books on this subject. I'm internationally known author now. My books have sold in 9 different countries other than the United States. And we have a major problem, and all you got to do is turn on the news and see it. We have an overabundance of debt and a real shortage of money. And as Representative Hilty said, we have exponential, but you know, the exponential is only on the debt because of the interest. It's not on the money supply. I have before me a chart I just got off the Federal Reserve Board website. And it says the M1 money supply is less than $2 trillion. M2 money supply is about $8 trillion, almost $9 trillion. But the total debt is around $57 trillion. That's not counting unfunded obligations. Now, it's clear that we have a lot more debt than we do money, and he is correct. At this time, all money is created as interest-bearing debt. And I have that also from the Library of I have it from many, many sources. And I'm sure all of you have seen my little yellow flyer, at least that I hand out when I think I've spoke to at least 90% of the members in this room at some time. And I have done a lot of research this. I have letters from the Congress, letters from the Treasury, letters from the Library of Congress, Federal Reserve Best System, and actually from the Department of Commerce here in Minnesota that says, yes, money is created as loans. Now, to really get a solution to any problem, you have to really understand the problem. And our problem is a real shortage of money and a great a surplus of debt, interest-bearing debt, by the way, which he constantly makes the debt grow. So this bill is so simple. It's like can't think of his name right now. It'll come to me in a minute. Never mind. An economist said that this money system is so simple, just the simpleness of it kind of confuses the mind. And that's kind of the way my bill is. It's so absolutely simple that it seems hard to get your mind around. Because the only way you can overcome a shortage of money and a surplus of debt is to increase the money without increasing the debt. And that's what this bill does. And we're very fortunate that we can actually do that here in Minnesota at this point in time. And unlike Representative Hoppe, I expect to see this bill passed and in the law before the session is over. Of course, I'm probably more optimistic than most people. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. And it's a very simple thing, because our state-chartered banks create money every day when they make loans. So there's no question they can create money, and by their own definition, they create it out of thin air. So now the simple thing to do is say, let's just make one small change in the law, and that's all we have to do. And now we pass the law that they must create some money for the benefit of the state and spend it into circulation. And it goes into circulation in a way that benefits almost everyone in the state, and that is by rebuilding and upgrading our transportation system. And it's that simple, and that's the only thing that would change. We wouldn't have to change the central banking law. We wouldn't have to change anything. In fact, I recently, through another person, received an email from the Department of Commerce, and this bill was particularly about, because the bill says the state banks would not be subject to reserves, and he could not get that through his head, so he sent it to Commerce, and they wrote back and said, well, state banks are subject to the reserve requirement, but that is not the issue here, and they are so right, because reserve requirements apply only when loans are made, and this bill does not require any loans to be made. So see, basically all the laws on the books about money don't apply to what we're trying to do. We're going to do, as Atkinson said, something that's never been done before. And that is create, well, at least not since we actually quit using gold and silver for money and barter. But this bill simply calls for the state banks, which would be a benefit to the banks, a benefit to the people of the state, and would provide for better transportation by simply changing one thing. They now create money just exactly the way they do, only they would spend a certain portion of it in the circulation so people could earn it when they rebuilt and did the construction work on the roads. And it's that simple. And it benefits everyone. There is no losers in this whatsoever. The banks keep right on doing what they do. The only difference is now you would not only get increasing ability to fund your roads, you'd get increasing the money supply, and the banks also would gain because now they wouldn't have so many bad loans. And they tell me right now that about 33% of the banks in Minnesota are in financial trouble on the watch list. So, in fact, I heard that actual statement in a Commerce hearing over in the Senate. And what I'd like to do, this bill is so simple that people just can't seem to grasp it can be that simple. In fact, I've had so many tell me, people, well, if it's this simple, why didn't somebody do it before? Well, actually, it's quite simple to build a plane now, but it wasn't when the Wright brothers first proposed it. And there's many other things. I think there's a lot of people here that think it's quite simple to use really complicated Atlantic equipment. And it's not so simple for me. It's not my thing. And all of us have certain talents. And I seem to have a talent to do what a lot of people don't, and that's to really think out of the box and come up with solutions that a lot of people just think are too complicated to touch. And with reserving my right to speak again, I would like now to quit and open it up for any of you to ask questions you might have that I could answer specifically rather than just going on with my presentation. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Dale. Members, any questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Can you just walk through what transactions look like? I mean, what lines of boxes are going? I've talked to you about this before. I'm still not 100% sure how that's going to go. I've got a project that's a construction project that's supposed to come to a state bank. Tell me what the state bank is supposed to do at this point.
Did somebody set up? Yeah, they're going to set up my whiteboard, and I could sure do that just in a few, very few seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Dale.
I don't mean to prolong the chair. I just want folks to be able to kind of see the graphs that I think we're seeing on this as well.
Yeah, we as long as it's quick, we like to move on in about 10 more minutes.
Brevity
at the most. Representative Hilty, is there anyone else you want to have come down and speak towards this, or just Mr. Dale and the whiteboard?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I don't have any other witnesses at this time.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with your permission, can I set this thing right here? Can most of you all see it? It's very simple. It's based exactly like the banks do now. Actually, I took it for accounting, and that's how I learned this. And today, 100% of the money is created this way, what they call the T-chart. When you go to the bank and you ask for a loan, you simply, and I think everybody in this room has probably done that, correct? You've asked for a loan. Okay, and I've done it many, many times. Okay, so when I do, they ask me how much I want to borrow, what I got in collateral, and then if we agree, they say, okay, would you please sign a promissory note? And then we're just going to use $100. Principle's the same. And that goes on my books as a liability to me and an asset to the bank. And then they take and go over into my checking account and create the money as a liability to the bank. Assets to borrow. And just like that, they have monetized my property for their benefit, that they get interest and they don't pay me interest, and I now have purchase power. I don't get the power to own, but I get the power to purchase. And there's a lot of difference between the two. Because I may have something in my possession and never get the right to actually own it, and that's actually what we do, because
the Library of Congress said when they put in the Federal Reserve System that the new money would all be based on the mortgages of all the people in the United States on their property. That's what backs your currency, which means that anybody that holds the debt could actually come take the property. Okay, now the actual, all that we propose to do is make one change. This is the change, the only change we'll make. Right now, this will go on probably as a goodwill asset to the people of Minnesota and to the bank. They will now get an asset, but there will be no liability created at that point. Everything else will be exactly the same. The bank will then will turn this into money, into the checking account. You will now have not only the right to purchase, the ability to purchase, but you'll also achieve the right to own because there won't be any debt. Now this money will flow in under this bill directly for the rebuilding and upgrading of our transportation system. I have personally contacted a Metro guy over the phone that has developed a transportation system where they can surface the road with solar systems, solar panels, and they can actually generate all electricity this nation would need just off the surface of the road. Can you imagine if we brought that to Minnesota and we funded him and got this going? Can you imagine the amount of economic growth we could start in this state right here, right now, and provide something that this nation needs? We wouldn't have to fool around with nuclear energy anymore because we wouldn't need it. And if you had a little bit of shortfall, as one person said, in Minnesota, you might not have enough sunshine. All you'd have to do is plug in some of this electricity from the wind towers we have, and this thing would work like a charm. And I think I've answered the question.
Yep, Mr. Dale, Representative O'Driscoll has indicated that his question has been answered. And members, I'm sure there are other questions, but Mr. Dale said earlier that 33%, a third of the state banks are on the watch list. I don't want anyone in the crowd thinking that they got to rush out and get to their bank. We are not about to have bank failure. That's just state chartered banks, and just because they're on the watch list doesn't mean there's a problem. It's just a watch list. Don't go home and take all your money out. Don't worry. Thank you, Mr. Dale. Members, any other questions?
Chairman Hoppe, I would agree with that statement.
Thank you. Members, other questions for Mr. Dale? Representative Hilty will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said at the beginning, I'm certainly under no illusion that the bill as it's proposed has any prospect of passing in the foreseeable future. But Mr. Chair and members, I think that what underlies Mr. Dale's proposal is something that is really very worthwhile thinking about. It took me a long time to understand how our monetary system works, and that, in fact, the only way money is created in this system is through the issuance of debt, and that there isn't any prospect for the retirement of that debt. When debt is retired, money disappears. If money disappears, it's the same problem that we have with not creating enough money in the first place to pay the interest. We don't have enough money to pay the interest. We're committed to a system that is based on exponential growth and that is simply unsustainable. We're experiencing a very rapid increase in the amount of debt that exists in the system right now. And at some point, I think we are going to understand that it is totally unmanageable. A lot of you do understand that in one way or another right now. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to ask ourselves, what sense does it make for a sovereign power, the United States government, to have given over the power that it has to create its own currency, which is specified in the United States Constitution, to a private entity, the Federal Reserve, bank, which is not a government institution. It is a private consortium of the major commercial banks in the United States to lend money into existence. Most of the money that is lent into existence is not in commercial loans or to private individuals. It's to the United States government in the purchasing of treasury bills. And we are on a course in this economy to keep creating more and more debt. At some point, members, this simply cannot work. And I hope that you will take the opportunity of just having your interest peak maybe a little bit here to investigate this on your own. I have a wealth of information that I can supply to you if you're interested. I did not bring a bunch of handouts here today, and neither did Mr. Dale. We're not talking about fantasy here. The facts about the way the system works are ones that are corroborated quite readily by representatives of the Federal Reserve System. We have a system that creates money out of thin air. And then, in order to use it in our economy, we have to borrow it. That makes sense to you? Don't try to inform yourself any further or think about the consequences. But if somehow that doesn't sound quite right, I think it would be a good idea to think about it a little further. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hilty.
Chairman Hoppe, could I have just one more minute?
You can have 30 seconds.
I'll take it. I just wanted to show you this chart. In 2016, pardon me, Chairman and members, that the debt will be so large that it's just 6% interest. The interest alone will be $5 billion greater than the total consumer income. Secondly, the Minnesota Constitution says the duty of the government to provide for security and benefit and protection of the people. And I personally believe that you have the power, you have the ability, and you have the duty to protect your people and provide us a medium exchange that we don't have to borrow at least 100% of it. And thank you.
Well, Mr. Dale and Representative Hilty, thank you. We are going to lay this bill over, but I think I can speak for all the members on the committee. Well, maybe I can't, but at least for me, when I talk to high school kids or college kids, which I do frequently, typically you get social issue questions about legalizing drugs and other things. The question I'm getting lately is about our national debt and the deficit, and I think it's something that all of us are concerned about on both sides of the aisle, and I'm encouraged that at least the youth that I'm talking to are asking those kind of questions. So thank you both very much, and members, with that, we will lay this bill over. We're going to try to do Representative Westrom's bill. He is still in Ways and Means, so we're going to start doing my bill, 1692, the telecom bill. And if Representative Westrom comes down, we will have him jump in, because we're going to be doing a lot more talk about telecom in the interim. So if we want to get going on this one, I'll pass the gavel to Representative Sanders.
Chairman Hoppe, to your bill, House File 1692.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is something that we have been talking about, at least maybe not in this forum, but unofficially all year. This is the framework. This is the AT&T bill. My intention, and after talking to Representative Atkins and Representative Johnson and others, is what I would like to do is start the discussion today and have everybody that wants to come and testify with the eye towards laying this over and having a day or two of interim hearings sometime when it's really warm down here, July or August, and talk about telecom reform, talk about access reform, talk about the PUC, what they're doing, what they need to do under federal law, what we would like them to do. We're not going to agree on everything. We're going to have different ideas on a lot of this. I think one of the things that we can get probably AT&T and most of the other companies to agree to is to take a look at reforming 237 and the other sections of statute that deal with the telecom regulations that really substantively haven't been changed since the Ma Bell days. So I think it is important to have discussions on this. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Bass from AT&T. And anybody that wants to come down, I don't know that we have a list of testifiers, but anybody that wants to come down and speak generally about telecom, for or against this bill or any other subject now, feel free to do so. If not, we will give plenty of notice for the interim telecom hearings, and we'll have a much longer, much more informative, much more relaxed session starting then. Members, I appreciate your patience. I appreciate so many people being here. And with that, I'll turn it over to the nice folks from AT&T.
Before you start, we're going to put you on hold here. Representative Westrom
has... Thank you for
your
support, members.
Yeah. Representative Westrom has arrived in committee, so at this time we'll move back to House File, looks like 997, the Westrom bill, and then we will return back to Chairman Hoppe's bill, House File 1692, after its conclusion. Representative Westrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing like bumping the chair when you come to his committee. So, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment with a small oral amendment. If you want to move it to get it in the shape, I think it would be better to have it in when I describe it.
Sounds good. Is this the A4?
Yes. And, Council, did you get a small amendment that added 211B after 10A from Gary Goldsmith?
Hold on one second, Representative Westrom, while we check into that.
Mr. Chair and members, I do have here what looks like an amendment to line 2.19 after 10 capital A, insert or chapter 211B, I think it looks like.
Correct.
211B, capital B.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Do we have a member willing to move both? First, let's move the bill and then move the A4. Do we have a member willing? Representative Crawford. Representative Crawford moves House File 997. And Representative Crawford moves the A4. Representative Westrom to the A4.
Mr. Chair, members, the A4 amendment pares down the bill and incorporates in several issues that have been brought to me by agencies and other persons, and an attempt to simplify and incorporate some of those suggestions into the bill. For example, exempting campaign finance law from this bill. Several of the provisions we had were duplicated in another set of section of statute. So rather than creating a new section of statute under Chapter 15, we've just merely added a couple provisions to Chapter 14, which already had similar criteria in many cases. That was a mimic of House File 997, and so that's the purpose of this amendment.
Members, any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, we will move on to a vote to put in the shape that the author would like. All in favor of the A4.
Mr. Chair, just the oral amendment should be on the A4 before we amend it.
Would you like to incorporate that? Representative Crawford. Representative Crawford incorporates that change into the amendment. All in favor of the A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Westrom, to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, Mike Hickey is here also from the NFIB, who's been instrumental in helping with this bill. But let me walk through it for you, members, the committee members. The essence of this bill is... named the Small Business Bill of Rights Regulatory Fairness Act, dealing with entities in our district that don't always feel like they know or have due process when it comes to a state agency finding them and penalizing them. We set out originally about 12 factors that the agency should follow. as we've gotten through this, we've pared that down to two more factors that the agency should take into account before they send a penalty. Six of those factors were similarly situated in Chapter 14, and so rather than creating a new section of statute, we've decided to add to those. What we would add is the cooperativeness of the party that that they have sent a penalty or a fine to, and also that the agency uses a benchmark of a similarly situated entity and a recent fine for a similarly situated party. Oftentimes, a business will get a notice and a penalty threat from an agency, and in my case, I had a business about 4 or 5 years ago that I've told the story in other committees about. After four and five of us legislators, senators, and House members, Representative Otremba, Representative Senator, former Senator Dean Johnson, Senator Dallas Sams, Senator Representative Heidgarken, and then Senator Ingebrigtsen after Senator Sams was no longer here. We all got involved in an issue between the entity, the incinerator in our district, and the Pollution Control Agency. And ultimately, the $95,000 fine was settled with a stipulation agreement of an environmental project and a $5,000 fine that the agency, the entity had to pay. But as we went through this process, and us legislators were saying, what is going on here? Why does this have to involve several meetings and so many of us to get involved just to bring reasonableness to the table? And ultimately, they did conclude that. But that, along with other scenarios that I hear about and members have come to me and talked about, led to the idea of establishing a little more due process for entities and small businesses in our state. And so that's the purpose behind this bill. Some of the issues were raised by the agencies. In for example, we've turned them into affirmative defenses rather than criteria that the agency has to account for up front. One of those would be the financial ability to pay for of a business, small business. The agencies were concerned that it would create more work because they'd all of a sudden have to get financial information from all those parties before they could assess the fine. I understand in some cases it may not be practical. Other cases, they may be able to resolve it without getting financial data. So what we've done is we've turned it into an affirmative defense for the small business. If they want to raise it, they can provide the financial data. Some may not want to provide that financial data. And so rather than make the agency come up with it, we allow the party to raise it as an affirmative defense. And so we've created three affirmative defenses among any others that they would want to raise instead of making it criteria for the agency up front to deal with. Two other parts of this bill quickly. We update the size and the amount and the value of a business of 500 employees or $30 million in size. That's who this would apply to. The other part, we update the Equal Access to Justice Act, which allows an aggrieved party to recover attorney's fees and expenses if they prevail. And we've added language, or the agency was not substantially justified in their original position, causing the entity to have to spend lots of extra dollars and expenses in legal fees and in fighting it. And we had testimony from Attorney Joe Matanowski to that effect in clients that he's represented in the courts, indicating they felt they would award it, but the law did not allow it, and this mimics federal law with the Equal Access to Justice Act. And so with that, Mr. Hickey can speak quickly if you want. Otherwise, we can just go to questions, whichever you choose, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we would like you to speak quickly. We give extra points for brevity. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I'm going to really concentrate on brevity here. I realize we've all had enough bill hearings this year, and maybe this is close to one of the last ones, but I really want to thank Representative Westrum for bringing this bill forward. The Equal Access to Justice Act has a long history of passed back in this legislature and in the federal government in the 1980s. It's got a long history of bipartisan support. Senator Reich Scott Young passed a major rewrite of it in 2000. A Representative Tuma helped on. Representative Mullery's helped out on a bill a couple of years ago along with Senator Petzl. This bill does the three things Representative Westrom talks about. And basically, we're trying to provide protection to a small business and they can really face the regulatory might of state agencies. And, you know, state agencies working off a budget, not worried about what they're spending per hour in legal fees, and small businesses wondering if they're going to go broke. This case is going to end their financial existence, and so the bill is a real protection for small businesses on the size difference. The only thing I want to note is back in 2000 we worked with Senator Reich Scott Young. We were trying to get very close to the federal definition of 500 employees, and we messed up on the revenue, saying and 500 employees and 7 million. That's really in reality 500 employees is not going to have 7 million in revenue. Anybody in business knows that, and we're trying to get something. That's the kind of revenue that a 40-person business, maybe a 30-person business is going to have. That's why we have the $30 million and $500. You have to meet both criteria to be eligible. And then finally, on the excessive demand provision, that is out of the federal law. We currently don't have that in our current equal access to justice statute, which we've had for near three decades now. But what that states is when a state agency makes an excessive demand and gets nothing close to it, the small business wouldn't have to prevail in the second part of the hearing and prove that they weren't substantially justified, which is in essence the second part of the hearing. Just on its face, the agency has lost badly, and a small business could get court costs and attorney's fees.
All right, thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, Representative Westrom, any closing remarks?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. Brevity.
Oh. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Come on down if you are. There is. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I want to thank Representative Westrom for being responsive to our concerns, and I think to the extent that we reflect those concerns of other small agencies who typically impose civil penalties only against individuals. Really, he did three things with this amendment. First of all, he incorporated his modifications into existing law rather than creating new law, which would be exactly duplicative of some things that already apply. These factors that you see on Section 1, they apply to the board. The exemption that we have does not remove us from these factors. We've always considered them, and we welcome the new additions. Secondly, this amendment incorporates a definition of party into the new provisions that actually limits it to small businesses. We were concerned because previous versions of the bill actually applied to all civil penalties against anybody, individuals, small businesses, and so on. Our civil penalties are primarily against campaign finance committees or lobbyists for failing to file on time. So we appreciate those things. And just to make sure that we don't have to give this additional 30-day notice before we impose a late filing fee civil penalty, Representative Westrom has excluded us from those provisions that apply to that special notice, and we appreciate that. Now, the reason for the addition of Chapter 211B is under bills that are on the floor in both bodies now, the board would be given some limited jurisdiction over that chapter, which is the Fair Campaign Practices Act, and so we wanted to make sure that that was included. So we thank Representative Westrom, and we don't have any problems with the bill.
Thank you, sir. Members, any questions for the testifier? Representative Nelson?
I guess the question is, I'm here looking at the notes on this. I did hear this in government operations, and I heard there was going to be a fiscal note. Did Representative Westrom ever get the fiscal note on this bill?
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I do not have a fiscal note that I've received yet on this bill. And Mr. Representative Nelson, our amendment we just worked on last week, so that's dramatically changed what they would have been working on. But if there is, I'll certainly make you aware of it.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Anyone else that wishes to testify? Sir, if you would, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, members. Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Smith. I'm the Director of Industrial Division for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
I would also like to thank Representative Westrom for doing an excellent job of amending his original bill. I think this has done a nice job of taking some of the largest concerns that we had with this bill initially and taking care of those particular issues. There are a few items, three items, I think, that are still of concern to the PCA, and they are a significant concern. Let me point those out for you today. The first thing is Section 2, line 2.3. This particular item requires that the PCA would provide documentation to the party subject to a administrative or civil action 30 days prior to initiating the action. First, we're concerned about the word initiating. We're not clear what that means. But more importantly, there is it's confusing to us why we'd need 30 days and why the regulated party would need 30 days prior to us giving them a whatever the enforcement action is. There is due process already built into the current processes if they were to receive an administrative penalty order and such that allows them to correctly appeal an APO. And other enforcement actions, administrative enforcement actions, it seems unnecessary to us that there'd be a 30-day period prior to us issuing that thing, especially given the fact that nothing would happen during that period of time. This is particularly important. Maybe many of you heard me testify prior to the passing of House File 1, and I certainly heard your words about the concern for speed, both in our permitting processes as well as our compliance enforcement processes. As we try to drive our systems to be more efficient and to give the regulated community an answer to their concerns, both in terms of permitting and compliance enforcement, faster, this is lengthening that period of time. And we're not clear on what benefit the regulated party would achieve by having this particular 30-day period. Second part that I think is important to us is Section 4, line 3.23. This is the case where if a civil action or contested case proceeding arises from an agency, the regulated party could seek attorney's fees and court fees. Our issue with this is the bill creates a much broader set of circumstances for a regulated party to seek and award attorney's fees and costs. It exposes the state to greater financial burden for pursuing compliance, and frankly, this is unnecessary given the existing legal framework that is already in existence, except during those most egregious situations. The benefit to the regulated party will be minimal. The benefit to their attorneys could be substantial. This, from our perspective, this helps the attorneys. In many cases, extends applications or the process for resolving noncompliance. It will pull my staff from doing field work and from helping regulated parties achieve compliance, and will put them back into doing court work. And I think again, this extends the period and does not serve the people or the businesses of Minnesota. So, just to wrap up, I think my third issue is. Just a bit of, we're uncertain about item number or letter D, line 2.7. We're unclear what this language is trying to get at. It appears to be working towards the issue of supplemental environmental projects. If we read it as we are suspecting, it seems to say that the supplemental environmental projects must be agreed upon by the project proposer. If that is the intent of this language, we'd prefer that this be clarified to say that particular issue. Otherwise, it appears that it hamstrings the agencies and the project proposers to address projects that might be approved by local the responsible parties and the agency. So we'd like to clarify or maybe get some clarification on that particular language. In closing, I think our point is that we are trying to be faster, we're trying to be more efficient, we're trying to use our minimal and dwindling resources more effectively. This legislation makes it more difficult for us, and frankly, in the long run, probably works against the 90 to 95% of the regulated parties, the businesses that are trying to do the right thing and comply with Minnesota's environmental laws. Thank you. I can take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Members, any questions? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe not a Mr. Smith, but does this only protect businesses so that if we've got a farmer or somebody in my district that's not a business that somebody that the PCA or somebody is after, they're not protected by this law, then is that correct?
Mr. Smith, Representative Westrom.
Representative Mullery, the first part would apply to them, but the Equal Access to Justice Act and the affirmative defenses would not apply to them if it's an individual. Now, a farmer, I'll double check, but I would suspect they're a business entity, so or would be construed under that. But that would, I think, they would be covered.
So, Mr. Chairman, if it's
Representative Mullery,
somebody that's not doing business as a farmer, but they're doing the same thing, or affecting the environment the same way, they would not be protected then? Is that correct from what my understanding is, what the testimony has been?
Not completely under this new bill. And Representative Mullery, we've pared it down just listening to some concerns brought along the way, and so if your concern is that it maybe is pared down too much. Is that, am I hearing that right?
No, Representative Mullery.
Chairman, no. I'm the other way. I'm worried about the fact that we're pairing it down just for business, and then I heard the campaign finance. I'm not sure why it doesn't apply to them all, why we're exempting them. It would seem that if we're making these for so that agencies don't do something that's overburdening or something like that, I think it should apply to everybody. I don't know why we're exempting them. I don't know why we're not applying it to individuals also.
A quick response, Representative Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, the thrust behind the initial bill was small businesses, and they are primarily the regulated parties we have in our state, and so giving them a bill of rights, so to speak, of things that they at least agencies know up front they need to follow, and small businesses can make sure they follow that. An interesting observation in 1994, I believe it was, or 96, the federal, on the Equal Access to Justice Act, the Congress adopted similar language, and we've got a copy of an EPA memo that, in short, or in paraphrasing, it basically sent out the notice to the regulators in the field and said, just be sure you've got your facts straight ahead of time so we don't send out erroneous penalties. Notices to businesses, and in short, that's what we're trying to achieve here. Let's make sure we've got our facts straight, set up front. The comments about the attorneys making recoveries on this, that's part of the cost that drives small businesses out of business if they have to fight city hall or state government. State government's got an unlimited supply, essentially. If they decide they want to put more resources to one area, they can do that. Small businesses don't have that luxury.
Mr. Chairman,
one last quick response.
Well, Mr. Chairman, he spoke for 5 minutes and never answered my question, so I do have the right to get the answer. If I'm trying to find out if this applies to two individuals. One in my district is a business, one is not a business, and they're doing the same thing, and the PCA comes after them.
No.
Representative Westrom.
The business would be affected. The other one probably not.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hickey, real quick. Representative Westrom just answered the question. So
I just want to try to shed a little light on that for Representative Mullery.
This bill has really changed a lot of Representative Mullery, but the original Equal Access to Justice Act, which we're also changing in here, our council reads that nonprofits or any entity under 500 employees would be eligible for coverage. Not individuals, though, but if you look in the original bill, an unincorporated business, partnership, corporation, association, or organization having not more than 500 employees, our council read that as nonprofits and other type hybrid organizations as long as they met the size and revenue targets. But that's for the second part of the bill that impacts equal access to justice. I believe Representative Westrom's penalty factor part only pertains to small business, I believe, but it's changed a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Seeing no further questions, Representative Crawford renews his motion that House File 997 be recommended to pass as amended to the Rules Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Amendment or the bill is adopted as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
We will move back to House File 1692. Chairman Hoppe and Mr. Bass, you are up. This time, if you would, sir, go ahead and introduce, I'll defer to Chair Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. If all of you remember correctly, this bill was going swimmingly. And I would like to say one more thing before we're running out of time here. We had a little bit of difficulty with the definition of brevity. We are running out of our assigned committee time, but if it's okay, I mean, members can feel free to leave. We're not acting on this bill today. I'd like to run the committee a little bit later, if we can, and give people a little bit more of an opportunity. And please, if you can stay, please do. Don't feel like you have to. Also, unless we have some sort of crisis or emergency, I think this is going to be our last official committee meeting this year for the Commerce Committee. So I would like to take this opportunity to thank Dan Dwight, our very capable committee administrator, and Bethany, the very capable committee legislative assistant. And normally Mr. Rubis is here. He's been replaced today, so that's that's actually a good thing. We did like Mr. Sullivan until he abandoned us today to go to Ways and Means. Okay, now we like him again. And last and certainly not least, the people that help us get things organized and straightened out have done a great job this year. Gina and Stephanie, if you guys want to stand up, you guys get a round of applause. Thank you very much. And with that, I apologize for all the delays. And Mr. Bass, please take over.
Thank you, Chairman Hoppe, and one word I do understand is brevity, and so I'll keep this.
We don't need to have a definition of that word anymore.
Okay. Chairman Hoppe and members of the committee, I'm Bob Bass from AT&T, and here today to talk about House File 1692, and I think while we appreciate the shout-out from the chairman, it's AT&T's bill. I think this is more, a better description would be this is a bill for Minnesota. The issue of updating telecom regulations and has been appearing in state legislatures across the country for many years. In addition, there's been discussion for the past several years about updating the access charge mechanism. Right now, it's actually the focus of a notice of proposed rulemaking at the FCC. For those of you who are counting, 21 states have addressed the access issue in this country, and 22 have updated their telecom regulations as well. Our neighbors to the east in Wisconsin actually passed out a bill today addressing both of those issues. The bill language that's before you today, I want to make clear, is not an agreement or something that across the board everyone has agreed to. I want to point out that it's more of a discussion piece in a way for these efforts to move forward. There's parts in this bill and the language that's in front of you that appeals to some of the companies and not to others. There's parts of this that are supported by most of us, and there's others that others don't agree to. Some of the companies that have participated in the discussions have been interested strictly in access reform, and others have been interested in updating the telecom regs in Minnesota. And then some have just been interested in preserving the status quo. Last year, almost to a day, this same committee heard a presentation on access charges and the mechanism. And from that committee, we set out to try and find some common ground in discussion. And since the that hearing last year and over the past year, there's been a lot of meetings between different sectors of the telecommunications industry. There's been local telephone companies, there's been long-distance companies, there's been wireless companies, and there's been cable companies involved in these discussions. And the intent of those efforts was to try and find some common ground and to put those efforts forth to reach consensus among all the groups to address these important issues, have a bill that this legislature could hear, debate on, and ultimately pass out and have the governor sign. And it's also key as well to understand that for an agreement with a number of companies, industries, or parts of the industry and different interests, it's going to be impossible to have everybody 100% happy. And I think in my experience, it's always been clear that generally legislation that passes, if your 80% happy in a particular bill or with some language, that's a pretty darn good day. Unfortunately, after a year's worth of discussions with a lot of companies, we haven't moved the needle much. As I mentioned, what's in front of you today is something that we want to work on and continue to work on because we feel it's ultimately important for Minnesota. That said, the companies that have participated over the past year are in the room today. One of the things that I've learned through this whole process is that we have some very fine people, some very interested folks who care about Minnesota. While we've disagreed a lot more than we've agreed during the past year, we've also laughed. Some of us have cried a little bit, but that's a different story. And all of those folks are in the room today. The fact that we have such good people, reasonable people, who care about Minnesota gives AT&T some optimism that we're going to be able to work and ultimately address all of those issues because we think it's important to find the solutions that this legislature can accept and that the governor can sign, because if these issues that are addressed in this bill before you aren't, in a few years Minnesota is going to have some critical problems. And with that, Mr. Vice Chair, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Members, any questions? Mr. Bass, we have a couple questions here. As Representative Lilly, myself, and even Representative Johnson, the former chair of the subcommittee on telecom, we would appreciate anything you could do to get service for AT&T in the basement or the ground floor. It's just something to work on. We'd appreciate it, though.
If I can answer real quickly using brevity, there's only one company that is allowed to have their equipment inside of the Capitol complex. The other providers are not allowed to place their equipment, so if you're a customer of a company that rhymes with Hint, you've got great service in here. The rest of us, it's marginal.
Verizon?
Thank you, Mr. Bass. Appreciate it. Any other testifiers in support of the bill, please make your way up. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please say your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And we're a trade association that represents over 80 telephone companies, both incumbents and competitive local exchange companies, primarily in rural parts of the state. I don't know that I can testify in favor of it. To be honest, I haven't read the whole thing yet. I came to talk to you a little bit about access and the effects that it has on deployment of broadband in rural Minnesota. Access and intrastate access is just one piece of the revenue streams and one stream that our members rely on to provide service in predominantly rural areas. Before the Quest CenturyLink merger, our membership represented over 50% of the geography of the state of Minnesota and 15% of the customers. So it kind of gives you an idea of the really rural areas that we serve. We rely on local service charges that come from the end user, access charges that are paid by long-distance companies to use our lines to get to their customers, and federal universal service support to be able to provide services and deploy broadband throughout Minnesota. And currently, the FCC is engaged in a concerted, serious effort to reform both access and federal universal service, and we feel that's important that Minnesota coordinate any state reform access with FCC reforms. One of the problems that we're going to be coming into as we move forward in these discussions and conversations is the difference between intrastate access and interstate. And unfortunately, you can't make a direct comparison about the rates because interstate rates have subscriber line charges. And on your phone bills, you have a slick charge that appears, and that was ramped up over several years in order to bring down interstate access rates. So it's a very complicated issue, and we're very concerned about the outcome. One of the other issues that we need to deal with here is whatever we do needs to be in lockstep with the National Broadband Plan. As Mr. Bass relayed, there's an NPRM at the federal level that's dealing with intercarrier compensation and access, and that issue is going to dictate a lot of the discussion that we have. There isn't going to be any way around that. So we have to make sure that whatever efforts we do here at the state level are reflective of it, because we don't want to have to go back and fix and change anything as we move forward. And finally, I'll close with by just talking about the end goal and the focus here. And it has to be on the consumer and what's in it for the consumer. So anything that we change in the infrastructure as we move forward has to have the consumer in mind and what's in their best interest and what benefit they're going to get out of that. So with that, the next testifier, Mr. Hammond from Blue Earth, is going to talk a little bit more in detail about the revenue streams and how they affect his company in particular. But before he does that, I will take any questions.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, we'll invite Mr. Hammond up to the testimony stand. Sir, if you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your brief testimony.
Thank you. My name is Rob Hammond. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Blue Earth Valley Telephone, which is an independent telephone company in southern Minnesota that is a part of Bevcom, which is four separate independent telephone companies. We provide services to about 11,750 people, 8,500 of which are business and residential broadband customers, and another 5,000 customers are cable customers. Much of our cable is brought to our customers over the broadband lines that go into the residence. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today about the intrastate access charges, and would like to basically summarize roughly what the income is for an independent company such as ours. First of all, we receive revenue from basically three services. One is the local access charge. The second is the slick charge that was referred to by Mr. Christensen. And the last one is intrastate and interstate charges that we receive. Much of the interstate, again, are part of the slick charges. An average bill for our customer is $27.71 before taxes. Of that, $9.79 is revenue that we receive from intrastate access charges. Roughly one-third of the revenue we receive comes from that. If we were to adjust our intrastate rates to the same level as the interstate rates, we would see a decrease in revenue per customer of $6.38 per customer per month. These are funds that have been used to improve our networks, to provide broadband services. In fact, in our exchanges, we have, for at least 90% of our residential customers, speeds of 15 megabits or higher, and have been able to do that in the rural area that is made up of communities, mainly in Faribault County and south of New Prague. I think it's important to point out at this juncture that we are looking at a national program that's being looked at by the FCC to address proposed rulemaking on unified intercarrier compensation. One of the difficulties that we have with regards to compensation and regulation of telephone companies, as well as cable and wireless companies, is that they're subject to various forms of regulation, some state, some local, and some federal. It's hoped that this proceeding, which is planning to have rules adopted by August of this year, will address many of those issues and address some of the concerns that we have before us today. I think it's premature for the state of Minnesota to move ahead of the FCC in this process until we know what the national broadband bill or plan is going to be, and then look at the rulemaking at that time. A Minnesota legislation that would be Minnesota only should not be adopted in a vacuum. It does not address the larger issues that are before the FCC at this time. Partial fix may be just an opportunity for other companies to take advantage of the system during the interim. And finally, we have no idea where the FCC is going to go on this, but it's conceivable that any legislation that takes place in the state of Minnesota could be preempted in various ways by the FCC when they do their rulemaking. With that in mind, I would request that you seriously look at the aspect of interstate access charges, and as indicated by Mr. Christensen, I think this bill is very important to the it has a very important impact on small independent telephone companies in the state, and I hope that you'd look at it carefully in your review of the matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Next on the list, I have Mr. Lipschultz. Would like to testify. You could make your way down, introduce yourself for the record, and then please proceed with a brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. My name is Dan Lipschultz, and I'm here on behalf of a group of competitive local exchange carriers, specifically TW Telecom, Paytech, Integra Telecom, and TDS Metricom. They're competitive carriers that really didn't exist as early as 12 years ago. And the reason competitive carriers like mine and Popcom, as another example, exist today is because of telecommunications law reforms back about 14, 15 years ago at both the state and federal level. There were no competitive carriers like mine or any others as recently as 15 years ago. And it was reforms to state and federal laws that brought competition to the marketplace, competition that we now enjoy today. First of all, we appreciate the efforts of this committee and Chairman Hoppe in attempting to modernize Minnesota's telecommunications laws, and we look forward to working with this committee and with Chairman Hoppe in that effort. My clients are small, and they're competitive and highly entrepreneurial. And so you might imagine clients like mine work on a fundamental premise that competition is better than government regulation. If you want to bring innovation, if you want to bring new products, if you want to bring lower prices to consumers, you're better off with a robust competitive market than you are with a heavy-handed regulatory approach. Having said that, I can tell you that you would not have much, if any, competition in the telecommunications industry without telecommunications laws and regulations, because this is an industry unlike any other. And that's why I would say, first and foremost, as you reform your laws, don't assume that the telecommunications industry should be regulated as any other industry. And I'll give you two reasons for that. First of all, the telecom industry is an industry on which all other industries depend. Think about it. I've heard folks refer to the telecom industry as the superhighway of the 21st century. All commerce today, all meaningful commerce, traverses the telecommunications network, and it depends on access to that network. It depends on the prices you can pay and whether those prices are economic for small and medium-sized businesses who really depend on robust telecommunications network and services, delivering high-speed broadband and everything you get over the telecom network. So it's unlike any other industry. Every other industry and business depends on the telecom industry. Secondly, the telecom industry is one which trends towards consolidation. You all know that, and you think about it just as Exhibit A, I'll look at the last announcement that AT&T is about to buy T-Mobile. AT&T, Verizon, and Quest, my clients call them the big three, have been buying and consolidating over the last 10, 15 years. This industry is increasingly consolidating, and that's a danger and a caution which I'd urge you all of you to pay attention to as you move forward on telecom reform. Because at some point, consolidation can potentially squeeze out the small competitors who bring innovation and competition that benefits consumers. Deregulation can be good, but it's got to be done carefully and cautiously. And I'll say that in my final thought to leave you with is, at the end of the day, if you want to have a robustly competitive industry on telecom to replace heavy-handed regulation, you need targeted laws that will ensure and encourage the continuation and further development of competition in this industry. And you'll need a strong, equipped, or I'll say a strong, fully equipped agency to enforce those laws and to police that competitive market so that you don't see the small competitors who bring this competition innovation squeezed out of the marketplace. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please,
Mr. Chair, if I might, while he's coming down, I appreciate everybody being here, and I apologize for this taking so long. The couple other things went a little long earlier, so thank you all for your patience, and again, just wait until August when it's warmer.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Sean Simpson, and I'm here on behalf of T-Mobile Wireless. Again, thank you for the opportunity to provide these brief comments here this afternoon. My comments are focused on a specific and relevant issue to access reform, namely access stimulation, or more appropriate, traffic pumping. Very simply explained, traffic pumping is when a LEC enters into, or a LEC or a local exchange carrier enters into an arrangement with a separate third-party free conference or chat room service provider, whereby the local exchange carrier supplies the chat provider with a large block of numbers, local numbers, like it would individual numbers for its local traditional subscribers who live and work in their service area. The chat provider then advertises the local number nationally, online or in print ads, as the number to call for these free conference services, which range from traditional conference services all the way to adult-oriented chat services. Now, receiving a local number, namely for the benefit of your adult chat lines, has the added benefit of avoiding the 900 number identifier. Why is this arrangement unique? It's unique because a traditional subscriber who receives a local number does so because they live and work in that area. The only reason the chat provider targets the area and obtains a local number is because of the high access rate that the LEC is able to charge a long-distance provider for delivering the call to the provider of the chat service, actually to the hardware that provides the chat service. Under the current access regime, the LEC is able to charge a high access rate because the access rates were intended to provide a subsidy to the LEC, who took the obligation to provide service in a sparsely populated area. High access rates allow the LEC to operate despite a small number of subs in comparison to metro or urban areas. The access regime here is relevant because the chat provider targets these high access area, and then through its arrangement with the LEC, it drives additional traffic or minutes of use to those local numbers, which they then charge an access rate for. The LEC turns around then and gives a large portion of that access revenue as a kickback to the service provider, to the chat room provider. More than likely, that LEC is actually a competitive local exchange carrier that is formed for the specific purpose of traffic pumping, and it usually doesn't have any traditional subscribers other than the traffic pumpers. The chat providers simply provide the LEC with a piece of equipment, a conference bridge that they plug into their central office. The chat provider is not local. However, a vast majority of the traffic pumping is local and takes place in Minnesota, Iowa, and South Dakota, because these states have a large number of rural LECs, meaning high access rates. These chat providers operate mainly out of New York and Los Angeles. But given the metropolitan nature of New York and Los Angeles, it doesn't make a lot of sense for them to get a local number there. Why? Because then they can't share in the access. So they come to where the access rates are high. When you have an arrangement between the LEC and a chat provider, you will see an explosion of minutes of use. A normal RLEC in Minnesota may average approximately 100,000 minutes a month for their traditional subscribers. When you give a chat provider a local number, the minutes of use skyrocket to about 1 million minutes a month, more likely several million minutes a month. This explosion of minutes devastates long-distance carriers and wireless providers like T-Mobile. They don't have traditional operations in Minnesota, the chat providers don't. Only a piece of equipment that they usually maintain remotely from New York or Los Angeles. They don't usually pay taxes in Minnesota, and they don't hire Minnesota residents. So what types of services drive these traffic pumping operations? Adult-oriented services, pornographic services, adult chat lines. These adult chat lines have traditionally been offered as a 900 pay-per-call service. But because the number is now local, they don't have that 900 distinction anymore. As a parent, you can easily block a 900 number. You cannot block a local number to an adult chat room like you can a 900 number. Adult-oriented services are advertised on the web, and it's crystal clear they're adult in nature. I think we passed out a Google search web page that shows very clearly that they're adult services and they're local Minnesota numbers. So as a parent, when you receive your bill, you will simply see calls that are local Minnesota calls. It's not likely to raise your suspicion that it's a 900 call. You can't block access to the local Minnesota call like you can very quickly with a 900 number. All in all, the traffic pumping scheme is nothing more than a blatant way to game and take advantage of the current access regime. It should not be allowed to continue. There's no legitimate reason why these types of adult-oriented services should be sponsored by the Minnesota access regime. There is a reason ELEC agrees to share 50 to 60 to 70 to 80% of the revenue that's generated from those calls. It's because it's found revenue. It's revenue they would not and do not expect to receive under a normal business model that respects the intent and spirit behind the access system. That is why T-Mobile advocates for the elimination of the traffic pumping opportunity that currently exists today under the current access regime. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify today for or against the bill? Again, seeing none, Chairman Hoppe, back to you.
Well, thank you, members, and thank you, everybody in the audience. I know we're running short of time, and I don't know if the DFL is caucus, but we do, and I appreciate your patience, and we will come back to this issue sometime in the interim. And with that, I'll move to lay this House file on the table for future review.
So moved, and members, with that, we are adjourned.